That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95bfm.com/bcasts.
We'll certainly need it, Will.
Oh, you guys have been very sassy today, I'll tell you what.
That was a 95BFM weather update. Thanks to climate change.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Lachlan Balfour toku ingoa, no mai, haere mai ki te Wire. Mō tēnei rā, kia ora and welcome to the Thursday Wire for Rapare, Thursday the 26th of April. It's Lachlan, your host, and I'm joined today by just about everyone. We have got my producers Ben and Jemima, and we've also got special guests of Sarah and Talia. How are we all doing today?
How are we doing? How's
everyone?
Amazing! Woo!
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah,
I don't have any headphones, so I don't
know
how loud
that is.
Okay,
are you going okay, Ben, despite having no headphones?
I'm coping.
Always coping. Right, well, we are excelling on The Wire today because we've got a great one coming up. No little nice segue there, okay. First up, Andrew Little joins me for our regular chat where we discuss Māori incarceration rates, drug and alcohol courts and protesting Anzac Day. Then Neutral Corner returns where we follow up on the Sergei Skripal poisoning case. Our Wire Worry Week is war and monuments, and we have Edwina Hughes from Peace Movement Aotearoa to discuss white poppies. Then Dr. Hirani Carr joins me to discuss Aotearoa's colonial monuments. Sarah and Talia also get the student opinion of Anzac Day from around campus. Finally, This Day in History returns for the 1960 ousting of South Korean President Syngman Rhee. Hia o whakaaro, if you have any thoughts to share throughout the show, we would love to hear from you. Tuku pātū mai, send through a text to 53195 or wire mai. You can call the studio to chat with one of us on 309-3879. Tuku a te poti ki te pai te hau. Don't forget to vote in our Twitter polls on @95BFMNews. What is the poll today? One poll.
The poll is, which of these would you wear on Anzac Day? A red poppy, white poppy, both red and white, or no poppy at all?
Which one's out in lead right now?
No poppy at all, with 70%.
Not terribly surprising. But yes, for now...
Now it's time for our weekly chat with Labour MP Andrew Little.
Yes, Andrew will join me again this week for our regular chat. This week we discuss Māori incarceration rates, drug and alcohol courts and protesting on Anzac Day. Here is Andrew Little. A recent report from the Ministry of Justice has found that Māori are 11 times more likely to face prison once convicted. Why is this?
Well, that's a good question and one that we, you know, we desperately need to find an answer to. But you look at the representation of Māori in a prison. I think 53% of the overall prison population, 62% of women who are in prison are Māori. There's something wrong. There is, at the very least, a systemic bias when it comes to Māori going through our criminal justice system. And like my colleague Kelvin Davis, until we kind of get on top of that, then you know we're going to face questions about the fairness of our justice system.
Because we've known about the systemic bias for decades now, but little seems to have been done about it. Why has nothing changed?
Yeah, again, I don't have an answer to that question. I know that certainly more recently, the police, who are kind of the front line of the justice system, the front door, if you like, are changing, you know, some of their policing methods. They are always trying to recruit more Māori into the front line of police because it is those early decisions about arrest and detention that are critical. Once you have your have the attention of the police, then if you're Māori, you're more likely to, you know, kind of go through the rest of the process. So it's those things, and it's once you're in the system, you know, how are we dealing with things? We've got Arangatahi courts for young Māori offenders. That is starting to make a difference in terms of reducing the number of Māori, young Māori heading off to the adult justice system and the prison system. But we're in early days in many of those sorts of things. We still have a long way to go.
Because, I mean, you've spoken about the rangatahi courts. Does there need to be more sort of tikanga concepts in our justice system?
I think, all those sorts of things help. The rangatahi courts help. I think what we do in some of the therapeutic courts, the alcohol and drug courts, the new beginnings courts, things like that. I mean, a lot of those courts, because they are dealing with not just the offending that the person has done, but the person's underlying circumstances that are, at least in part, a cause of their offending, the more those courts can be responsive to cultural needs, then I think that'll be better as well.
Do you feel this also because it's once they've been convicted, so once they've sort of gone through the system, I mean, are there fewer options available to the Māori who might be from lower socioeconomic backgrounds so they can't afford to sort of pay redress that would get them a lighter sentence, or they don't have the conditions needed to have home detention?
Yes, all those things are relevant. I mean, housing, we know, is a big issue, or housing poverty. So if you don't have a decent address or an address that the police are prepared to accept you being bailed to, then you won't get bail. You'll be remanded in custody. And the same happens with parole as well. If one of the parole conditions is you've got to have a suitable address to go to and you don't have it, then you'll stay in prison longer. And that is arguably more likely to happen to Māori offenders and prisoners than it is to Pakeha. And I mean, it goes back to a bigger issue, which is, you know, where does offending most often take place? Most offending is in lower socioeconomic communities. Members of lower socioeconomic communities are more likely to be victims of offending than others, and so that kind of vicious circle then starts to kick in, and then you see the kind of the systemic bias at play.
Do you have any plans at the moment to address this bias?
Yeah, well, that's why we make a big priority for us is certainly a child poverty reduction sort of strategy, which is aimed at families that the children are part of, as well as alleviating housing poverty. That's why we're making such a big deal about housing and getting more affordable housing built and social housing, because we know that's a big barrier to a whole heap of things. And then in the criminal justice system itself, I mean, it's a big sort of task of work we have at the moment, putting together kind of outreach and stakeholder consultation and getting the brains trust assembled and community engagement about what we can do to improve the performance of the criminal justice system when it comes to these issues.
Moving on to the alcohol and drug treatment courts, they are struggling. Can you sort of talk about the courts and what they aim to achieve?
So what the alcohol and the drug courts do is provide an intensive level of judicial supervision. So rather than what typically happens in the district court, you get done with alcohol-related offence, often driving, sometimes assault and other things. The judge will sit in front, yep, you plead guilty or not guilty, you pleaded guilty, yes, bang, there's a fine or there's some sort of community sentence, whatever, and that's it. And you might not see the judge, or at least until you appear the next time. But no one is really paying attention to what you're doing and whether the underlying causes of your offending have been addressed. The alcohol and other drug court says, right, well, look at the person. And look, not everybody qualifies to get into it. There are conditions to get into that court.
It is quite strict entry, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Because, look, it requires an intense use of judicial resources, that is to say, judge time. So, so you go to the court, you'll be assessed in terms of your, you know, what the problems are. If you've got addiction problems, you need help with that. And then you'll appear in front of that judge every couple of weeks and account for yourself. And have you been on this course? Have you done this? Have you had a drink in the last 2 weeks? If you have, what were the circumstances? How do we prevent that happening again? If you haven't, you go for a certain period of time and there's milestones that you reach. And there's a bit of a celebration every time you reach a milestone. And then on top of that, you draw in the family as well. I mean, the times I've sat in on those courts, it's been amazing to see family members alongside the offender, and you talk to the family members and they say what a difference it is, that they feel better about helping their spouse or their loved one because they know that everybody's going to front up in front of a judge again in a few weeks' time and they have to account for themselves. And it's making a big difference.
The average wait for treatment is 2 months in these courts, with some people having to wait over 100 days. Do you feel these times are good enough?
No, they're not, and we know that's been a problem in our health system for a while. Is we just don't have the residential places. We don't have even the non-residential places. We're struggling to meet the demand that's on them. So we know, and I think part of the mental health review that Minister David Clark has commissioned is looking at that addiction services and support as a priority area for us because we know there's a huge shortcoming there at the moment.
Because the groups providing the service, well, they basically said it's there's just not enough money going into it. Do you think your government will put more money into these?
I can't look ahead of the budget. I can't make specific commitments, but I can say that it is an area of priority attention for the government. We know that there are shortfalls. We know that there need to be more places, and that means more funding for those places, and that's an area that we're actively looking at.
And you said they are, I mean, they are quite successful in achieving their goals, but they do have very limited entry. Do you think there could be any chance of expanding the kind of drug and treatment courts?
I'm certainly keen to see an expansion of the therapeutic courts. I mean, so they are more resource intensive, but I think there's, you know, it must be better to have somebody out in the community, but with a more intensive level of judicial supervision, than having them in prison at a cost of $110,000 a year. So it's about getting those economics right, but also it's about making sure that when people go, you know, into that sort of process or that sort of court, that they are properly assessed so that the chances of success are good. And if they're not, then we need to know what the causes of that are and people get the right help they need.
And just finally, Anzac Day was yesterday, and every few years there's a bit of a to-do over protesting at Anzac. Do you feel people should be able to protest there?
Oh, I think it's a fundamental right to protest, including at Anzac services or ceremonies if you want to. I certainly wasn't aware of any protests yesterday. I didn't see any reports of any. I attended the mid-morning civic one in Auckland. I wasn't aware of any protests. But look, you know, people need to be free to make their point. But, you know, there are some actions that have the potential to cause considerable offence. I know in the past there have been flag burnings.
Flag burnings, yeah, that's...
And that has caused offence. But, I mean, you know, people who want to make a point, want to make a protest, have got to judge carefully about how they're going to most effectively make that point. But as a country that, you know, that cherishes freedom of speech and freedom of expression, then, you know, you can't put a whole heap of rules around that. You've got to rely on people.
That was Labour MP Andrew Little. The Wire.
And now it's time for Neutral Corner.
Say with a smile.
They can't hear you. Do-do-do-do-do, Neutral Corner.
Each year, Ofcom deals with thousands of complaints from viewers and listeners about programmes they've seen and heard on TV and radio. As the UK's broadcast regulator, we can consider complaints about programmes transmitted by all broadcasters licensed in the UK, as well as the BBC and S4C. However, we cannot consider complaints about accuracy and impartiality in BBC TV and radio programmes. These complaints have to be dealt with by the BBC.
That was taken from the YouTube page of Ofcom, the United Kingdom's broadcasting regulator. So as you heard, they can't do the BBC, but they are responsible for all other news shows, including that of RT, an international news channel financed by the Russian government. Earlier this year, someone or several people later complained about their coverage of the Sergei Skripal poisoning case, which is now being investigated by Ofcom. This hasn't deterred them, apparently, as they continue to produce news pieces which question the British government's official narrative.
There was no trial, no discussion, no evidence, no proof. There was only judgment and punishment.
It is highly likely that Russia was responsible. We do hold Russia culpable for the attempted murder.
More than 100 Russian diplomats were expelled by Britain and its allies. They were told to pack and leave. Russia replied in kind, tit for tat. Moscow wasn't asked to defend itself. It was told only to confess.
We're all confident about the identity of the culprit, and the only question is whether he will first confess.
The press led the mob. Pundits marched forward, proclaiming Russia's culpability and guilt. They needed no proof. What they wanted was fear, ratings. They said the government had all the proof it needed.
Are you ready to point the finger of blame, Foreign Secretary?
Sir, is there now certainly a Russian connection? Is the government going to accuse Russia?
Poisoning of Sergei Skripal is not an isolated case, but the latest in a pattern of reckless behaviour by the Russian state. The Russians. The Russians are Russian. Russia. Russia. Russian. Russian denial.
I'm afraid the evidence is overwhelming that it is Russia.
The UK Foreign Office tweeted that the Novichok nerve agent used in the attack on Sergei Skripal and his daughter came from Russia. And then it all went south.
We have not verified the precise source.
You have not been able to establish at Porton Down that this was made in Russia.
As I said, it's our job to provide, you know, the scientific evidence that identifies what the particular nerve agent is.
So to be clear, you're not able at Porton Down to say where it is from?
We haven't yet been able to do that.
Britain's top chemical lab said that they had no idea where the nerve agent came from, in direct contradiction to Boris Johnson's claims. Claims that he used to convince his allies to boot out Russian diplomats.
That was Novichok, Behind Nerve Agent from RT, mainly focusing on a misunderstanding Boris Johnson had about the origin of the nerve agent in question. So this was... are you laughing there, Lachlan?
Keep on going.
All right. So this was about this lab, Porton Downs, the Foreign Office, which Boris Johnson is the head of, said that they had confirmed that the agent had come from Russia, when more that they were saying that they'd confirmed it was the nerve agent in general, which itself was originally produced in the Soviet Union.
Bit of a distinction there.
Yeah, and the Foreign Office said it was a misunderstanding, but you can see RT is more trying to present it as, like, this is part of a wider sort of smear campaign.
If you were to step out of your neutral corner for 1 second, what do you
think? You know, I cannot do that.
But, you know, hypothetically. What do you reckon, Ben Jemima? You reckon the Russians did it?
Well, that's not really the point of that.
Well, okay.
It's more about, I guess, was this a misunderstanding? Probably what happened is the Boris Johnson or whoever at the Foreign Office didn't really understand the distinction and just rushed with it and took it. And then RT managed to pick that up and use it to present their argument. Anyway, for contrast, actually, sorry, just reading my script, I wrote, well, it was quite funny about the RT thing, is it was quite sort of meme-based. Like, at one point, they had, like, keep calm and blame Russia.
Love a good meme, trying to get their millennial audience involved.
Yeah. So anyway, in contrast, we have a much more formal clip from the English equivalent of RT, the British Broadcasting Corporation, or BBC, as it's always known. And they interviewed someone who claimed
to... Google that.
Talking over me
the
there.
C stood for.
Well, it could be like commission or something else. Company. Anyway, they interviewed someone who claimed to have intimate knowledge of Russian chemical warfare.
Vladimir Ugliev says he created the Novichok that was later used against the Skripals. It's been identified in Russia by the code A234. How certain are you that the substance which you synthesized is the one that poisoned the Skripals?
I have no doubt that it was A234 that poisoned them. Judging by how pure the test sample is, this may well have been a batch I made with my own hands. It has a long shelf life, virtually no expiry date.
The nerve agents were developed and tested in southern Russia. One day, Vladimir Ugliev was involved in an accident there.
My right hand got covered in nerve agent. I put it in hydrochloric acid straight away, then washed it with a special alkali solution with hydrogen peroxide. You could say the Skripals and I were baptized with the same Novichok.
As for the poisoning in Salisbury, the scientist is convinced his country was behind the attack.
You'll never prove it, unless you find the actual test tube that contained the poison. But the logic of events suggests that this was Russia, and so did the actions of our leaders. They were quick to shout, "We didn't do it," just like a thief who points the finger at someone else.
Yes, that was an interview by the BBC's Moscow correspondent and Vladimir Ugliev. And actually, news is just coming in now that that guy has been hit by a car
breaking
in Russia.
News.
I don't know how breaking
well,
it is earlier this week.
Breaking
but
it now.
I only just found it out.
Certainly bone-breaking news.
Indeed. Too soon.
Probably.
But the guy, he says he thinks it's just another sort of 70-year-old resident of the village he lives in, and that he thinks it's an accident, but still it's a bit, you know.
It's a bit of a coincidence.
Cold War back again, people getting hit by cars.
Yeah. Is that our analysis?
I think it is. Do you want to say anything?
Well, I think, you know, I just think it's... I think it's interesting the way the two are treated.
What two?
Well, RT and BBC.
Right, how
because
are they
they're both fully funded by the state, aren't they?
I believe so.
But the BBC certainly gets a lot less.
I mean, I think the BBC advertises and something.
No,
no, right.
You know, the TV license pays for it. But I don't know. I feel people kind of see the BBC as not having this bias at all. I mean, really.
Well, I think the idea is that the BBC is managed by like a trust, and that there is also.
But they still certainly have to cave to political pressure.
But that they also work for a government which is actually democratic, unlike in Russia, and that has like. Standards.
Fair, fair, fair. But
because I mean, just the BBC, their political editor got censured, Laura Kunzberg, for misinterpreting the leader of the opposition. Mm. So if it was just the mouthpiece of the British government, then
but you know who is a mouthpiece for no one?
The Wire.
The Wire. Hey. Yes, and you're tuned into The Wire on 95 BFM. If you have any thoughts to share on anything we've spoken about so far, we would love to hear from you. You can text us on 53955 or call us on 309-3879. We'll be right back after a short break.
Welcome back to Use Your Mouth, where Aaron is up against a formidable opponent.
It's loud, it's noisy, it's a fruit-packing machine.
Looks like Aaron's playing it safe, stepping outside to have a word about the noise. Okay, let's listen in.
Hey, boss, I reckon those rubber dampers are buggered. The racket's only getting worse.
Shut the gate! She's opened her mouth!
Yes, your mouth's a great bit of safety gear. Use yours to get talking.
Work safe. Getting you home healthy and safe. That's what we're working for.
Traffic on the Western Motorway is, it's pretty rough, actually. Southbound this evening. Wow, really? Okay, avoid that one. Tristam Ave? No. Okay, well, traffic is, maybe sit this one out, hey?
The 95BFM Traffic Report. Every weekday on Breakfast and Drive. Reminding you why it's better just to take the bus. The 95BFM Traffic Report. Thanks to Skybus. Airport Express. Book online and save. Skybus.co.nz.
What are you even worried about? It's Worry Week on The Wire.
Okay, so white poppies are the international symbol of remembrance for all of the casualties of war, so that is civilians and armed forces personnel, and also a symbol of peace. And some people choose to wear them because they want to remember all of the casualties of war and the reality of war.
So could you just explain how white poppies are different to red poppies?
Well, there's two things. Firstly, they're white.
The colour.
The colour, that's right. But also white poppies are a long-standing symbol of peace going back to the early 1930s.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said before, they're a symbol to remember all of the casualties of war.
Is it controversial to wear a white poppy rather than a red poppy in New Zealand, do you think?
Well, that's a difficult one to answer. Obviously, we don't think that it's controversial at all.
And it shouldn't be.
Well, it's just everyone should be able to remember the realities of warfare in their own way. Mm. And this is something that people all around the world choose to wear white poppies around whatever the Remembrance Day is in their country. You know, so for example, in Britain and Canada, it's usually around Armistice Day. In Australia and New Zealand, it's usually around Anzac Day.
White poppies have been accused of taking away from the red poppy appeal for war veterans. What do you think about that?
I think that is an interesting position for anyone to take. They don't take away from red poppies. I mean, red poppies is a very widespread campaign. White Poppies for Peace is a comparatively small campaign. We don't have so many collectors and so on and so forth. But the thing is that it's really just a simple matter of having white poppies available if people choose to wear them. And some people wear a white poppy, and some people wear a red poppy, and some people wear both.
poppies are obviously poppies in themselves as the flower are like quite a lovely thing that grew out of the battlefields, out of the First World War. Do you think that poppies themselves sanitise what war truly was?
Well, poppies obviously have a longer history than World War One.
Yes, yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, they're a flower that sort of grows all in different parts of the world and so on and so forth. I'm not quite clear what your question is.
So do you think using a poppy to remember the war and to promote peace, I suppose, do you think that is the best, the best symbol of that?
Well, like I said before, it's a symbol that people can choose how they remember war. And some people choose to have the white poppy. I was interested watching the news last night. Some people choose to have vintage car rallies, apparently, on Anzac Day. So that's the whole thing. It's just really about how people choose to remember the realities of warfare. The other thing, actually, I should say, given that you're a student radio station, or a university one, the White Poppies for Peace, all of the proceeds from White Poppies for Peace go to White Poppy Peace Scholarships.
I was just going to ask you about that. What are White Poppy Peace Scholarships?
Okay, so they're fully funded by the White Poppies for Peace campaign, and they're awarded usually annually, not every single year, but they have been. They started in 2009, and there's been 7 scholarships awarded so far. And if anyone who's listening to your program is interested in applying, there hasn't been a scholarship awarded yet for 2018. And if they go to peacescholar.org.nz, then they will find all the information there where they can apply.
Perfect, thank you. So why do you think that it's important that people have the choice to wear white poppies around this time in New Zealand?
Well, it's always important for people to have choices, but I guess particularly important around issues that involve life and death. And some of us choose to remember all of the realities of warfare. And so the focus being on both armed forces personnel, but also on civilians. Civilians tend to be the biggest casualties of war. It's a way for people to think about the realities of war, particularly around this time of year. White poppies are actually available throughout the year, and some people get them for different peace events during the year.
Where can you find them?
Well, the best thing to do is to go to the White Poppies for Peace website, which is whitepoppies.org.nz, and there's an order form and all the information is available there.
Irirangi Pōhō, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
Yes, continuing on with our Wire Week topic and talking about Anzac Day, we've got two very special guests in the studio. I'm joined by Sarah, it's more special than you, Ben.
Hey.
Sarah and Talia, how are you both going today?
Yeah, good.
Yeah?
Great.
And briefly introduce yourselves.
Mm-hmm.
I'll go first, okay. So I'm Talia and I am a student at Birkenhead College.
Hi, I'm Sarah. I'm a student at Auckland Girls Grammar School.
Yes, and you guys have some Vox Pops coming up. What are those about?
Well, seeing as it was Anzac Day yesterday, myself and Sarah decided to go and ask a few people about Anzac Day and basically what it means to them.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Let's give it a listen.
What does Anzac Day mean to you?
Remembrance. Remembrance of the all the people who sacrificed during that time.
Remembering the sacrifice of, you know, forefathers and other generations that let us live in the relative peace we have today.
Okay, and do you celebrate Anzac Day? Like, do you wear the poppy?
No, not really.
What does Anzac Day mean to you?
What does it mean to me? It's a day to, like, remember our fallen soldiers and, like, just a day to kind of appreciate our country.
Okay, one more question. Do you celebrate Anzac Day? Like, do you wear the poppy?
I didn't this year. I didn't really leave the house this year. But typically I would. I would like to go to the dawn service and stuff like that. So, yeah, probably not as much as I'd like to.
I guess because with our older brother, he used to serve in the Air Force for New Zealand. So I guess it does mean quite a bit to us, especially having family been in the military.
Do you celebrate Anzac Day?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, we don't make it to every dawn service. But, like, yeah, we appreciate the day.
So the first question is, what does Anzac Day mean to you?
This is going to sound callous, but a day off work. But it also means celebrating, remembering our dead soldiers from the First World War, particularly, but all other conflicts as well.
Do you celebrate Anzac at all?
Only as much as I spend the day with my family. And I went to an afternoon service in Poinchelia, where I live.
What do you know about Anzac Day?
It's an annual event held every year for Australian, New Zealand people to remember the soldiers who died in the First World War particularly. Yeah.
Yep. Thank you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, you two. That was great. I do love a good vox pop. But continuing on with our Wire Week topic, dotted around the country are reminders of New Zealand's colonial past in the form of statues. Many of the people in these statues committed atrocities in their time, and their legacies are being reevaluated. I spoke with Dr. Hidani Carr from the University of Auckland about these statues, what they represent, and what should be done about them in 2018.
There's been a lot of discussion recently around statues in other countries with the likes of Cecil Rhodes and Robert E. Lee being pulled down. We've not really had much of this discussion in Aotearoa around our colonial statues. Why do you think this is?
So, firstly, there's been quite a bit of discussion around statues in Aotearoa, but amongst Māori, since they've been erected. So that's one thing to consider. This is about Pākehā becoming woke. To New Zealand's history, which is, a thing. But I think the other issue is it's become an issue for Pākehā because it's become an issue in the States, for example, which is, you know, whatever it takes really to get this discussion going is important. But, Māori have been aware of these issues since forever in some ways.
So do you think people or Pākehā in New Zealand have just kind of stayed willfully ignorant around the issue?
Yeah, I think so. You know, it's an interesting mix about how societies, Pākehā society, forgets its past. I mean, you know, Americans are just as good at it, Canadians, Australians, because, you know, who really wants to remember that, your country, your wealth, your privilege is founded on the invasion of another people and the continued oppression and suppression of another people. To forget is quite a relief from that, I think. And also... you know, the way they never really understood that in the first place as well. So better not to discuss these things, better to forget them. And that they're coming back can be painful, and you get the comments and stuff, or the New Zealand Herald, which is, you know, people's discomfort at having to grapple with their past.
I suppose, do you feel people sort of look at these statues and don't really know the history behind the people in them?
Yeah, of course. But we can all be guilty of that. And the Marmaduke Nixon statue in Otahu is probably a great example of that. He led the charge against, the brave charge against women and children at Rangiawhia in the Waikato, and massacred women and children. And yet that statue's been sitting there forever, and everyone's, oh, cool, that's historic of some sort. That the story's been rediscovered recently, again, by Pākehā's been... an interesting process. Look, even Great South Road. I mean, the road was developed specifically for the invasion of Waikato and the taking of their lands. That's another memorial that we travel on every day. We talk about George Grey very casually. There's places named after him. You know, we're surrounded by these, whether they're statues or names or places, we're surrounded by this history that we tend to ignore on a daily basis.
So even just across the road in Albert Park, we've got a statue of Governor Grey, who oversaw some pretty bad things, land removals, slaughtered many Māori. I mean, does...
Well, not personally, right?
Well, not personally, but... Yeah. Do you feel sort of having statues of these people, people kind of look at them and say, well, I suppose they can't have done anything that bad, or else there wouldn't be a statue of them?
Yeah, I think it does send a problematic message, with these statues. It tends to accentuate certain parts of their history and therefore of New Zealand's history, while ignoring others. I mean, but you know what, give them some fangs or something, and you know, that'll make it a more representative statue. He's a complicated person, but was responsible for some terrible acts. And if you're from the Waikato and you see that statue in all its glory, and it is a glorious statue, the thing is huge, and very phallic in that that kind of way, but if you saw that and you're from the Waikato, you're just reminded of the pain of having all of your land stolen, of people starving to death after the wars, of a long history of poverty caused by that man. So it's real the pain is real for a lot of people, and the pain has been ignored, and to have him glorified in that way unquestioningly is, of course, very problematic.
So do these statues kind of act as a constant reminder for Māori of, well, just the bad past that we've had in this country?
Yeah, I think so. Well, here's the other little irony. I think we should be careful of looking at these statues as our bad past, because, well, let's be honest, we have a pretty bad present.
Mm.
You know, Māori health, education, justice statistics are really evidence that we haven't gotten over anything, really. The ability that now we're in a great moral high ground and we can look back and judge, you know, our Pākehā ancestors, well, I think we should get our own acts sorted out first before we, you know, do that one. Like, you know, to look back and say, oh, we did terrible things in the past is to, in some ways, forget again about our present, and we need to be careful about that. You know, how much energy we put into the past without remembering the present.
What do you feel should happen to these statues? Do you think they should be pulled down?
No, I think they should be, in fact, I think in some ways we should accentuate them, you know, to remind ourselves of our past. You know, these statues represent really the foundation of New Zealand, and I know this is heretical after our glorious celebrations of Gallipoli yesterday, but really, you know, New Zealand wasn't founded in 1840, New Zealand wasn't founded in 1915, it was founded in the 1860s with the invasion and the military conquest of Māori, which enabled the establishment of the state as we know it today. So, you know, we need those statues to remind us of how we were founded, of who founded us, and to remember the mistakes of the past. But I think for every statue, we should erect another one next to it, which tells another way of thinking about this, an alternative narrative. But if we pull them down, you know, we might just forget who we are and what we did and what we're capable of, in which case we might do it again.
Because I suppose it is quite easy for some people to say, well, these atrocities occurred in the past and this should just be part of our history and we should leave them alone. But we are still seeing the effects of what these people did today, aren't we?
Yeah, absolutely. Like I was saying, you know, the Nixon statue in some ways is probably, you know, that statue represents the foundation of New Zealand better than any other, you know, better than the Waitangi Museum, unfortunately, because it was about military conquest and invasion for settler greed and gain, you know, and capitalism, effectively. And so, you know, to leave it there, to think about it, to understand it better. And that is one thing I think we do quite well. You know, that for all these statues, we have the Waitangi Tribunal. They'll be bringing out the report soon on Dangiawhia, where Nixon was responsible for killing these women and children. You know, we have tried to tell our own honest story. Whether we listen or not is another thing. But, you know, we're not America. We don't just, you know, take the knee at football games and all that kind of... you know, we're a bit, I like to think we're a bit more thoughtful. And because we're smaller, we're more capable of, you know, I don't know, maybe I'm just naive. We'll see.
Do you feel there certainly needs to be more education around these statues and the people in them?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, and partly that goes to there needs to be more education about this country and our own past. In general, you know, history needs to be taught more and probably better across the country. And I think these statues in particular, again, you know, we need to know the full story of these statues, what's behind them. But I think if we get rid of them, we'll miss that opportunity in some ways, you know. And although it's painful, you know, we should still leave them there but learn more about them for sure. And then I think that process is happening a little bit. We're doing it right now, aren't we?
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
But a lot of them sort of commemorate wars and talk about friendly Māori on the government side. I mean, the wall, I believe, at Auckland University was erected and used to have a little plaque that said something along those lines.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, what do you think of these ones?
Yeah, well, you know, the wars of the 1860s and early 70s were complicated in some ways. You know, the invasion of Waikato was fairly straightforward. However, Ngāti Porou, for example, my own iwi, we both fought alongside the Crown for our own names and against the Crown for our own names. Both were really with the same objective of maintaining our own rangatiratanga. but different ways of achieving that. And friendly Māori, yeah, I mean, there's statues around the country dedicated to rangatira, to chiefs, to iwi that other Māori find offensive for various reasons, different sides of the equation, for example. So, you know, it's not always the easy binary of, you know, goody, baddie, oppressor, oppressed. History's nuanced, right? And I think getting our heads around that's pretty important as well.
Worry Week on The Wire.
Yes, talking about monuments, Jemima.
Yes, Lachlan. Yeah,
an interesting little bit of news.
Yeah, an interesting little bit of news. A memorial in Montgomery remembering the victims of lynching has been put up by...
Good thing, does it?
Yeah, it's a good thing. It's... What the statue looks like is that it's 800 coffin-shaped boxes of oxidized steel hanging from a square canopy. It's to remember those that were hanged and beaten and, lynched.
Taken throughout a history. More into their own hands back in the day.
And it's more, it's sort of comes from a Black Lives Matter slavery sort of movement today. Interesting fact about it as well is that it was built on a budget of only $15 million when major national memorials tend to cost $100 million and up.
Well, so yeah, I'd say more statues of that and fewer statues of Robert E. Lee and the like, eh?
Mm.
But, speaking of history...
Well, it's not about Robert E. Lee.
Citizens, to this day in history with Benjamin J. Goldson.
It's not about Robert E. Lee. Ben, what is it about?
Now, somebody's probably equally controversial. This day in history taking us back to 1960 with the resignation of South Korean President Syngman Rhee. Rhee had gained a reputation for brutality during his four terms as president, which had begun after the Declaration of Independence of South Korea in 1948.
Arriving at Kimpo Aerodrome near Seoul, Korea, are General of the Army Douglas MacArthur and Mrs. MacArthur to attend ceremonies formally proclaiming the end of United States military government in Korea and the formation of the Free and Independent Korean Republic. Supreme Commander MacArthur meets Dr. Syngman Rhee, first president of the new republic, comprising 19 million of his countrymen in southern Korea. 10 million others in northern Korea are still Soviet-dominated and voteless. The Korean flag is raised to honor on the third anniversary of Korea's liberation, America's promise of her independence.
Shortly after South Korea came into existence, Rhee would win a suspiciously high percentage of the vote in the country's first ever presidential election.
Time in Korean history, its citizens go to the polls to choose a president by popular election. In every town and village, they learn the democratic method as they inspect the posters and campaign literature displayed for their benefit. All the Western electioneering methods compete. Even sound trucks are employed to lure the voters to the polling booths. Leading figure in the campaign is 77-year-old Syngman Rhee, who is opposed by three other candidates. The election was called after President Rhee asked for a constitutional amendment which would permit the people to vote directly for their chief of state instead of having him appointed by the assembly. 7 million respond to the new order of things. Many of the voters are illiterate, and the problem is solved by permitting them to dip a small bamboo stamp in red paste and press it against numbered symbols on the ballot. President Rhee is returned to power with an overwhelming 5 million votes out of the total 7 million cast.
As president, Rhee would clash with his northern counterpart, Kim Il-sung, with conflict eventually breaking out between the two in 1950 with the Korean War.
In Korea,
United Nations troops push on in the cautious advance against the communists. An advance whose purpose, General Ridgway states, is not to seize ground, but to wipe out the enemy. The Chinese Red Army, fighting desperately in small isolated stands, prefers to give ground on wider fronts rather than join battle. And it's up to the infantry to clear out the pockets of die-hard communists. With the enemy falling back to the Han River, United Nations commanders had expected that the Reds would make their stand there. But under a steady, withering barrage, GIs are able to cross the river and establish a beachhead. Within 2 hours, a pontoon bridge spans the Han, and United Nations troops and equipment pour across toward the capital city of Seoul. Moments later, Chinese communists, prisoners, are being marched to the rear. Too falls into United Nations hands, this time not as a prime military target, but as the result of the clean United Nations sweep up the Korean Peninsula. The once proud capital of the Korean Republic is a mass of ruins whose able-bodied men have been carried off to forced service in North Korea. Children and the aged are left to see the liberation of their city. Seoul, Mutt and the Marines take over. For once, the Marines almost meet their match as spring thaws slow down the United Nations push. The Marines came back into action only recently from the Hungnam beachhead. Despite obstacles, United Nations forces drive on to the 38th parallel, border of North Korea.
That was part one of this day in history. Part two will continue after the break.
It's your Kiwaha o Te Wiki, your saying of the week. This week,
He raru ki uta, it's only a minor problem.
Oh my god, I got the last question wrong in my test.
All good, my mate, he raru ki uta. He raru ki uta, it's only a minor problem.
It's your Kiwaha o Te Wiki, brought to you by Ngā Tauira Māori.
Don't assume you're immune. Even if you've had your childhood vaccinations, if you're under 19 years old, you may not be completely protected anymore. Simply check if you're up to date by visiting your student health centre or GP and put your mind at ease. For more info, visit getimmunised.org.nz or call 0800 466 863.
At this radio station, we do our utmost to abide by the Broadcasting Standards Authority and their rules and guidelines. If you seriously think we've crossed the line on air, give us a call on 309 4831 within 20 working days of the broadcast date and tell us about it. We'll be able to help you out and tell you the procedure if you wish to make a formal complaint to the Broadcasting Standards Authority. Fuck knuckles, cock and piss. Balls. Thank you.
Yes, we now return to this day in history. When we left off, the Korean War was raging, with the North supported by the Soviet Union and China, while the South received the backing of the United Nations, especially America.
Greatest headlines of the century. Dateline, Panmunjom. August 5th, 1953. In a moment, the story. Hours after the signing of the armistice in Korea on July 27th, 1953, the final artillery shell of the campaign was fired with a rakish gesture by the weary UN troops. A ceasefire had ended armed hostilities that had begun as a test of the free world's firm stand on communist aggression whenever and wherever it occurred on the face of the earth. The troops that just a few hours before had been clawing at each other in dead earnestness now joined in this moment of relieved celebration. Peace had come to Korea. The United Nations police force smilingly returned from the front on foot and by truck. One of the strangest and most unorthodox wars in history had ended by mutual consent on both sides. And now came the moment that the loved ones and friends at home anxiously awaited. The repatriation of prisoners of war by both sides. The communist forces had played a brutal game of cat and mouse with their daily reports of the names of Americans in their POW camps. Now the truth would be known. Beginning on August 5th, 1953, a seemingly endless parade of prisoners from both sides began. The released South Korean soldiers didn't have far to travel to reach the welcoming arms of their loved ones. Scenes of unbridled joy like this were commonplace in the streets of Seoul. All told, some 12,670 United Nations prisoners were repatriated by the communist forces. Not all of them could make it under their own power. Some were dazed and shocked, evidence of the communist brainwashing technique. Of the more than 75,000 communist soldiers released in the trade, the vast majority still harbored bitter hatred of the UN forces in their breasts. As a mark of disdain, upon reaching the neutrality of the Panmunjom exchange area, they shed their lone prisoners' uniforms even as they were carried on stretchers. The first Americans home were the wounded and the ill. Flown to the United States, they managed weak smiles and waves to the family and friends waiting anxiously to shower them with affection and relieved embraces. The others arrived by boat at San Francisco, a happy bunch of warriors. Some, veterans of World War II as well, they had risked their lives for a cause whose basic issues were at best muddled and unclear. But it was a battle that had to be waged, and they knew they were the lucky ones. Over 33,000 of their buddies were left behind in simple graves on the Korean countryside. The police action was at an end. The living could rejoice.
Yes, as you heard there, a ceasefire was declared in 1953, with Korea divided into the two halves, of which they remain today. In the south, and despite mounting discontent with his rule, Rhee maintained his increasingly autocratic control. In 1960, he won a fourth term for president, having been the sole candidate.
200,000 persons in Seoul Stadium hear members of the opposition Democratic Party campaign for election. South Korea is going to the polls to choose a president and vice president. As this huge rally would suggest, voter interest runs high, though not to the benefit of the Democratic Party. A record turnout of almost 95% of the eligible voters gives an overwhelming fourth-term victory to President Syngman Rhee and his Liberal Party running mate Lee Ki-pung. Though Rhee is unopposed, his opponent having died last month in Washington, the one-sided outcome in the vice presidential contest points to clear-cut support for Rhee. Almost 85 years old, Rhee is shown at the polls early on election day. He wins another 4 years at the helm.
But Rhee would not serve out those four years at the helm, because student and labor groups began to demonstrate against their new president later that year, and he responded with trademark brutality. These protests would intensify after the discovery of the body of a high school student.
Seoul, capital of Southern Korea. Riots on the scale of revolution. More was to follow, but it already looked like the end of the road for President Syngman Rhee. In earlier rioting, police killed 130 people, wounded close on 1,000. That only incensed the population. By now, 30,000 risked battle with the police. Not even a tyrant like Rhee could go on ruling in face of this. This time, the police were once again too much for the people, but later, when 500,000 made a mass revolt, President Rhee said he'd resign and agreed to hold the election again. It seemed like victory for justice in South Korea.
On this day in history, having faced weeks of protest, Syngman Rhee, the first ever president of South Korea, resigned.
President Rhee has gone from the political scene, thrust out by the revolt of the people. It amounts to revolution in Southern Korea. Even while thousands mourned in Seoul, the capital, Syngman Rhee turned his police on the rebels and thought he could ride the storm. In a lifetime of struggle, he'd always come out on top. This time, the grief was too deep. The people could stand no more. On the eve of the old president's surrender, feeling in parliament ran high. Rhee's henchmen still tried to wrench triumph from near disaster. Then came the news that the hated vice president, his wife and sons, had died in a suicide pact. Rhee himself resigned. But as we go to press, the old man's luck has not quite run out. He is still alive.
Thank you for another informative This Day in History, Ben.
You're always welcome, Arkham.
I am. But...
That was The Wire.
It was The Wire. Before we finish, actually, should we check our poll? How did it do?
Well, right. Our poll, which was, which of these would you wear on Anzac Day? 7% said a red poppy, 20% said a white poppy, 2% said both red and white, and 71% said none at all.
Interesting. Anyone here wear a poppy?
No.
So
you wondered, neither.
I was... Yeah,
the
I didn't
youth
go
of today,
yeah,
eh?
I didn't go anywhere near where you could get them.
The youth
well, if you
of
can get
today.
Them everywhere, that's no excuse.
But a big thank you to everyone who spoke to us today. Edwina Hughes, Andrew Little and Hirini Carr. Thank you to Ben and Jemima, and also to Sarah and...
Talia.
Thank you so much. Up next is Sigrid with the 1 to 4. So I'm very bad with names.
A 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.